Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with author Arna Bontemps Hemingway. Next up, novelist Patricia Engel. Patricia is the author of Vida and It's Not Love, It's Paris. Her debut, Vida, was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Fiction Award, a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection, among other honors. Patricia's fiction has appeared in The Atlantic, A Public Space, Boston Review, Guernica, and Harvard Review, among other publications, and received awards including a 2014 fellowship in literature from the National Endowment of the Arts. Her latest novel is The Veins of the Ocean, published by Grove Press. I spoke with her earlier in the week and began by asking her to introduce the book.
Sure. The Veins of the Ocean begins in Miami, Florida, and you quickly learn about Raina, the narrator's family story, which begins with her brother's terrible crime that he's committed and for which he's serving a death sentence in a Florida penitentiary, and her life revolves around visiting him on death row until he passes away rather unexpectedly, even though he's on death row. And for the first time, her life is in her own hands, so she decides to move south to the Florida Keys to kind of reinvent her life far from where anybody knows her or her family. And once they're in the Florida Keys, she meets another character named Nesto, who's a recently arrived Cuban exile with a very complicated past of his own. And together in their companionship, their stories kind of merge together, and the novel takes you there through Miami, the Florida Keys, to Havana, where Nesto is from, and also to Cartagena, Colombia, where Reina is from.
And as you mentioned, Reina's really the protagonist, and we get the story from her point of view. And she's complex, and she's sympathetic, but she also behaves badly. Can you talk a little bit about developing her, and in particular, the attention you pay to her flaws, and how you balance, you know, the good with the bad?
Well, for me, good and bad are really not separate things. I think everybody has potential within them to be what we call good and what we call bad, and I think those are kind of like value judgments that society has invented to define people in limited ways. I wanted to show the real full range of a person who is the product of a family, and as you get to know her, you learn that there's a long line of trauma within this family and that's passed on from one generation to the next, and everything that she is, as you learn through the novel, I hope you understand how she got to be that way. And her journey in the novel is kind of reckoning with that. She's endured a lot. She has done a lot. I hope that a reader can see why and can appreciate her on that level. But of course, by the novel's end, she does come to many realizations, and there is a significant change by the end of the novel.
And I'd like to talk about the beginning of the novel, approximately the first 30 pages, because what struck me about that part of the novel was that you get it going from 0 to 60 so effectively already by just that far. We have a very layered plot. And so can you talk a little bit about the plotting of the story and how you got it going so rapidly?
It was a lot of experimentation, really. I wrote that opening actually as a short story on its own. So in the actual writing, that was my mental design for it. It would just be a short story. And when I write short stories, that's my goal, to get them up and running as quickly as possible, because you're limited by time and space. But also, as I understood that it would grow into a novel, I knew that those opening chapters needed to bear the weight of the entire novel. The entire novel, I think, needs to be impacted into that first chapter. All the threads and all the origins need to be present there in one way or another. So it was a lot of, you know, threading and rethreading and trying to make every sentence, you know, do double, triple duty to have some sort of significance that would make it resonate all the way through the novel.
And that's interesting about the origins as a short story. Can you talk a little bit more about taking it from a short story to the bigger world of a novel, and also like how that realization settled on you? Like, did you know by the end of writing the short story that it was going to grow further, or how did that work?
Well, I write a lot of short stories in addition to writing novels. So usually what happens is I write a short story and that's all it will ever be. This one was different, and I understood it was different from the very beginning. I was working on other books. I wrote two other books in the meantime after I wrote this story, before I came back to it to write it as a novel. But it lingered for many, many years. I didn't yet know where it would go or what I would do with it, what would happen to Raina and her life. But I was open to it. So I think I was open to it for so many years that story started growing within me in my subconscious and started telling me what it needed to be.
Would you read to us from your book?
Sure. I'll read a little bit from the beginning. When he found out his wife was unfaithful, Hector Castillo told his son to get in the car because they were going fishing. It was after midnight, but this was nothing unusual. The Rickenbacker Bridge, suspended across Biscayne Bay, was full of night fishermen leaning on the railings, catching up on gossip over beer and fishing lines, avoiding going home to their wives. Except Hector didn't bring any fishing gear with him. He led his son, Carlito, who just turned 3, by the hand to the concrete wall, picked him up by his waist, and held him so that the boy grinned and stretched his arms out like a bird, telling his papi he was flying, flying, and Hector said, "Sí, Carlito, tienes alas, you have wings." Then Hector pushed little Carlito up into the air, spun him around, and the boy giggled, kicking his legs up and about, telling his father, "Higher, papi, higher," before Hector took a step back and with all his might hoisted the boy as high in the sky as he'd go, told him he loved him, and threw his son over the railing into the sea. Nobody could believe it. The night fishermen thought they were hallucinating, but one, a 6-year-old Marielito, didn't hesitate and went in after Carlito, jumping feet first into the dark bay water while the other fishermen tackled Hector so that he couldn't run away. The police came, and when all was said and done, little Carlito only had a broken collarbone, and Cielo Soto, the fisherman who saved Carlito, developed a permanent crook in his back that made him look like a big fishing hook when he walked, until he died 10 years later. Hector Castillo was supposed to spend the rest of his life in prison. You know the way these things go. But he killed himself right after the sentencing, not by hanging himself from the cypress tree in the front yard like he'd always threatened, since that's the way his own father had chosen to depart this life. No. Hector used a razor purchased off some other lifer in a neighboring unit, and when they found him, the floor of his cell was already covered in blood. But Carlito and I didn't hear about all that till much later. Since Carlito had no memory of the whole disaster, Mami fed us a story that our father died in Vietnam, which made no sense at all, because both Carlito and I were born years after Vietnam, back in Colombia. But that was before we learned math and history, so it's no wonder she thought her story would stick. And forget about the fact that Hector was born cojo, with a dragging leg, and never would have been let into any army. In fact, the only clue we had about any of this mess was that Carlito grew up so scared of water that Mami could only get him in the bathtub once a week if she was lucky, which is why Carlito had a rep for being the smelliest kid on the block, and some people say that's why he grew up to be such a bully.
Thank you. That was Patricia Engel reading from her new novel, The Veins of the Ocean. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And so, yes, I mean, that gets the novel going. And then we go from there, and we already, in the section you read, start to segue more into Raina's head. And it took me so long to figure out that the book was narrated in present tense. And, you know, some backstory in past tense, but in terms of using present for Raina's primary thread, was that something that you played around with, or was that a clear choice from the beginning?
It was a clear choice because, like you said, there's a lot that happened in the past that is still very present in the present. So I needed to obviously differentiate the two, but also I like the immediacy of the present tense. In this case, there's so much intensity that happens both in the past and in the present, and I wanted the reader to be able to sort of work that stuff out with Reina as it's happening to her.
There's also a fair amount of dialogue in the book, I noticed, and you have a knack for dialogue. And so I wanted to ask, how do you go about crafting your dialogue? Is it something that comes easily to you, or what are some of the tricks, if you have any?
Well, I think most people enjoy dialogue but struggle with it at the same time. I as a reader, I get bored by dialogue very quickly. So that's just my personal taste, and I really try to kind of keep my dialogue to a minimum in a sense that it also has to be essential, revealing something about the characters. And so I work hard so that the dialogue is significant and not is not just, a way to kill a few pages in the writing. But that also really just has to do with how I am as a reader. I'm a bit impatient when it comes to reading dialogue.
And within the dialogue, and maybe elsewhere, there's code switching with Spanish. And so I was wondering whether that was something that came up with your editors, or whether you were given free rein, or I don't know. I think it's relatively rare, although we do see it in Junot Diaz and other authors do that. But can you talk a little bit about using Spanish language in the novel?
Well, I do that when it's true to the voice of the character. I obviously don't do that for every character, only characters that would naturally, reach beyond English in order to express what they need to express, as is common for anybody who speaks more than one language and has access to multiple languages. So if it's true and authentic to the character's voice, I don't hesitate at all. My editors, this is my third book with them, and they know how I write and how I feel, so I've never faced any resistance whatsoever. And I think that it's also indicative of what's happening not only in society and the fact that bilingualism is so common, so prevalent, and language is not being lost anymore as a consequence of immigration like it was in generations past. And you're seeing that reflected in literature more and more often.
And how about research? Because in the novel, there are some topics that you go into depth with, such as diving and dolphin behavior and the trade market for them, as well as prison life and conditions on death row. Can you talk about the research and where it came in the context of your writing, whether it preceded it or whether the story, worked its way into those areas and then you had to do some research after the fact, or?
For the most part, it was simultaneous. There were a lot of things. As I mentioned, I wrote the opening chapters of the novel many, many years ago, and then I was working on other things. So I was doing research, all the while, but in a limited way. And I was also just living my life, and a lot of times just living life opens you up to new possibilities in the writing as well. So when it comes down to it, though, when I really dedicated myself to this book, which was over the period of about 4 years, I did substantial targeted research, as you mentioned, with diving. I took up free diving, became a certified free diver. I had already volunteered with a dolphin marine mammal rescue group, so that was just something that I was interested in on my own because I live down here in South Florida, and I love the ocean, and that also worked its way into the novel. And then other elements, all the research that has to do with Cuba and Colombia. I made many trips there as well. With prison, I knew a fair amount already, just based on my own experiences. But the Florida prison system is very particular and specific, so there was a lot for me to investigate with regard to that. And a lot of it also, all the way around, came from personal testimonies that I read or heard, or people I spoke to through the course of the research.
So I'm interested that you had personal experience with the dolphins, but Because there's this, I don't think this is a spoiler to talk about the parallel that one starts to see as a reader between the penned dolphins and the imprisoned death row inmates. So can you talk about the process of that parallel emerging for you as the writer? Like, was it a flash or was it something that was more gradual or?
Yeah, I think captivity is captivity, you know, and life forms experience it all in the same way. To be imprisoned is that's it, you know. So, I that hit me at some point in my life, separate of writing this book. I've lived here in Florida for 12 years now, and I happen to live right next to an aquarium, you know. So. I'm constantly aware of this, and I also live next to the ocean. So next to the ocean, the aquarium, and I'm confronted with the differences, you know, constantly. And somehow this started to seep into my consciousness. And also I was working with a rescue group, particularly during two key periods, which was after the Gulf oil spill. And also after a red tide, which there was a mass beaching of dolphins and manatees. And it's living in such close proximity to the ocean and interacting with the environment and the natural world on a daily basis started to affect me. As I said, you know, when you're open to research, life starts to change you in a way, and feed the book. It's not all just, you know, spent in a library researching. It's pure life, and somehow that came into the story.
It is interesting. I mean, I think it takes courage, though. I'm just interested in those leaps and those connections.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to Patricia Engel, author of the new novel, The Veins of the Ocean. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And could you talk just a bit more? So you dedicated 4 years to the writing of this novel after the short story had been written and it had been working on your imagination. Did you outline, or how did you take it from there?
Well, so the book was living inside me, you know, when it was just a short story, but I finished writing my first book, Vida, during that time, and then I wrote the entirety of my second book, It's Not Love, It's Just Paris, during that time. So, of course, as things would occur to me, and I was so deep into another project, I would keep notes. But my note-taking is very, very loose. There's no structure to it. And my outlines are like that, too. They're really just kind of sketches. There are moments, especially when I kind of get to around 80 or 100 pages, and I have this deep fear of losing sight of the book, you know, like hitting that wall at 100 pages when you forget what you're doing and the book dies there. So at that point, I kind of create a very loose blueprint of myself just so that I can keep moving forward. But it's nothing that I'm afraid to deviate from. And it's constantly changing, and I constantly rewrite that blueprint as I move forward. So sometimes it helps me just to kind of organize my thoughts and not forget crucial things that I want to, you know, to include. But I always go off course.
And Patricia, do you have an MFA?
I do.
Oh, okay. And do you? We talk sometimes on the show about, you know, MFA versus NYC and pro and con. Are you? Do you find yourself drawing from the skills that you developed as an MFA student, or are you pro, or how what's your stance?
I mean, I don't think that education can cause you any harm, even in the worst circumstances. In my case, I came to the MFA program after many years working, and I didn't major in creative writing. I studied other things and worked in other things. So what the MFA gave me above all was the discipline to produce and keep producing. And taught me critical skills. I read a lot, and I worked with other people and learned a lot about the editing process. So I really didn't hope for more. I wasn't, you know, hoping it would change my life. At that point, I just wanted to be able to leave my working life to write for a couple of years and see what happened. So for me, it was valuable, and I would recommend it to just about anybody. It's not to say that this is the only way to go about becoming a writer, but I think that if a person has the right perspective and realistic expectations, that it can be a very good thing.
And how about nowadays in terms of revising? Do you have a critique partner, or do you have beta readers, or how do you get that first feedback?
No, I will write something through to completion and revise it on my own as much as I possibly can before I show it to anybody. And I did have friends that I exchanged work with some time ago, but I pretty much only show things now to my agent and my editors.
Wow. So, Patricia, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd love to ask you if you have any advice for the writers listening who are trying to soldier through that initial draft and make it to the end of their novel.
Well, I know it's difficult, and it can be very lonely, and it can be very isolating and thankless, and it's difficult to see, to remember why you're doing it a lot of the time, other than feeling that internal, propulsion to get up each day and fight against time in order to write what you're writing. But I would also remind you that the reward is in the work. The reward doesn't come after. Sometimes writers think that, oh, when a book gets published and it's out there, that's when you'll feel like the real joy of completion. And in my experience, that's not the case. In my experience, the true joy is actually in the writing. And what comes after is, of course, a necessary experience, and it's good in a different way. But the joy is in the writing, and I would encourage you to remember that and embrace that. And the journey of writing a book is where the real rewards are.
Well, Patricia, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was Patricia Engel, author of the new novel, The Veins of the Ocean, published by Grove Press. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for The Come Down with Jessica Lowe, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.